Today's podcast is sponsored by GenesisCare, national independent cancer care provider and experts in breast health, diagnostics and treatments.
Hello, welcome to another episode in series three of And Then Came Breast Cancer, the podcast for everyone whose life has been touched by the disease. The Future Dreams Breast Cancer Charity believes that no one should face this on their own and wanted to create a podcast series which would be there 24 hours a day for those dark, what am I going to do moments when your life gets changed too. I'm Victoria Derbyshire and my world changed in 2015 when I was diagnosed and I could have done with a podcast series to help me. So this, we hope, is an honest friend, not just for you, but for your own family and friends who are also looking for guidance, support and answers. Today, we are revisiting the subject of surgery. We've done episodes on what kind of surgery you might need and also how far you can go to make sure your opinion is taken into account when these decisions are made. Not to work against the doctors, surgeons, nurses and the whole medical team, but to work with them. This episode is seen from the perspective of a breast cancer surgeon. And we will hear some of your questions too. Thank you for sending those in. And understand how surgeons sometimes make the decisions they do. We have three guests. So as is tradition on this podcast, can I ask you to introduce yourselves?
My name's James Richards, and in February this year, I was diagnosed with stage three breast cancer, and I'm the founder of MOOBS, the UK's first dedicated breast cancer organisation.
For men?
For men.
Right, just to be clear. Yeah.
To clarify.
Yeah, fair enough. Hello.
Hi, my name is Lou McKenna-Mays. I was diagnosed with breast cancer in September 21. I have gone through various types of treatment. I have, literally on Monday, I was giving my first year of NED, no evidence of disease. Very exciting. Mm. And I'm also here to talk about a book that I've been developing, which I think we're going to explore throughout the podcast.
Which is really relevant to surgery and the kind of decisions that are made.
Yes.
Hello, hi. I'm Harleen Deal. I'm a consultant, oncoplastic breast surgeon and reconstructive surgeon. I've been a consultant in Hertfordshire at the QE2 Breast Unit in Welwyn Garden City for 12 years, but I've been in the NHS for 26 years, and my passion is getting the right operation for the right patient.
Well, you're all very welcome. Thank you for being with us. James, how did you find out you had breast cancer?
So I was just sitting in the office back in February, and I was on a client call in a meeting, crossed my arms, and I sort of thought, found a small kind of little lump. Didn't really think much of it. And it was only because a colleague had actually had his own scare a few years beforehand, which turned out to be benign, that I kind of knew that breast cancer for men could be a thing. Mm-hmm. But even then, it took me about 4 or 5 weeks before I even thought about booking a doctor's appointment. It was just one of those things that, you know, for many, you don't really think about it. The awareness isn't there. And then my GP was very, very quick, referred me. And then I sort of kind of got on that conveyor belt straight away. So that's sort of kind of like my story. But it was something that really kind of changed my world out of the blue. It's something you don't expect, men getting breast cancer.
Absolutely. And Louise, how did you find out you had breast cancer?
So I'd gone for a boob health check. Essentially, my husband had died a couple of months before my diagnosis.
God.
He was climbing Ben Nevis, raising money with his corporate team for Macmillan Cancer. Mm. And my children were concerned that I was going to die. And so his company gifted me my husband's health check. Mm.
You take your time, honestly.
I went along for the Booper health check more because my kids were worried that I was going to die as well. Mm. Of course, from my point of view, I was really fit. Mm. We'd just been on holiday for a week. I was undergoing a full house renovation at the time as well. And looking after a puppy and running my own business. But I went along for the Booper health check. I had no idea they discovered the lump there and then.
How old are your children, Lou?
So at the time of diagnosis, they were 21, 13 and 9.
Right.
Yeah.
Good God, you had a lot going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really did.
Yes.
Goodness me. James, there is breast cancer in your family. Is that correct? You have the BRCA gene?
That's correct. So I was diagnosed with BRCA 2. It's from the feminine side. So there was no men in my family that could diagnose that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my nan had been diagnosed with breast cancer. Her sister and also my aunt. But, you know, we had no idea that it was a genetic thing until I started my treatment and we got those results.
So how did that change the advice you were given about surgery?
So I was always told at the beginning I'd be undergoing a single mastectomy. Mm-hmm. I was told if it had come back as genetic, the results, then there'd be the result that I'd need a double mastectomy. So halfway during chemotherapy, came back that I was a carrier of the BRCA2 gene. But within 1 week, I sort of went from that single mastectomy to a double, back to a single, and now something called a central excision, which is more a sort of removal of the nipple and some of the breast tissue. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the only reason why I sort of avoided the double mastectomy is because I spoke to a genetics expert. And it kind of brings back to sort of why I set up Moobs, and it's the point of having that funding and research so people know. You know, there's 370 diagnoses of male breast cancer, you know, a year. And, you know, surgeons or doctors are unlikely to see this. And the experience they have is with women. So it's a kind of cookie cutter approach, as you would sort of assume. Mm. But the physiology is different. And I think that's the important thing to kind of grasp. So for me in particular, obviously dealing with male breast cancer and then the uncertainty of what surgery would look like. You know, it's something that kind of gets into your head a little bit. And as soon as you sort of find that terra firma, that firm ground, the sort of rug is kind of pulled underneath and it's sort of a new set of circumstances. And, you know, this isn't going to be unique to me. Everyone's going to have their own unique journey. But it was just that whole thing about, you know, your self-image and thinking, what will I deal with? And then think, okay, I'm happy with this. I can get over this. And it's like, well, no, actually we're doing this now. Right. So yeah, the genetic side did have an impact in a sense, but like I said, I think that's more the sort of female pathway.
Okay. Lou, how did you feel about surgery and what did you have?
Oh, okay. So I had a lumpectomy. So to start off with, I was from the day I had all the tests done, and I was diagnosed with a grade 2, 1.5 centimetre, grade 2, stage 2 mm-hmm. Lump. So first treatment was a lumpectomy. So I had my first lumpectomy operation 2 weeks after diagnosis. There were elements of that operation which were really tough, obviously. One of them was telling my kids. We were also not even living in my house at the time because we were undergoing a full home renovation. But I did have 4 nights recovery in a hotel divan in Henley with my best friend.
Brilliant.
Okay.
As part of that surgery.
Right.
But we didn't get a clear margin. And also,
you're going to have to explain what that means.
Okay, so clear margin is when the surgeons are removing the tumour, they're looking for a clear margin, which is essentially a centimetre around the tumour.
Yeah, it can be less.
Yeah, and they didn't get that. Mm-hmm. But also, it was upgraded to a grade 3. I then had another operation to remove the tumour. They didn't get a clear margin again.
No. I mean, I think
and then
that's
because
not right,
of my first
anyway,
lumpectomy, I also
we'll
had
take
a
that little bit out.
Of disease in my lymph node. I then tipped into the chemotherapy pathway. Mm-hmm. So I then had to have chemotherapy for several months, whilst then knowing I was going to have a mastectomy at the end of my chemotherapy as well. And so then it was all around.
Because there hadn't been clear margins
in
the
lumpectomy.
Yeah, because no
clear margin.
Understood,
yes.
yeah, understood. Okay.
And yeah.
Okay. How typical, from a breast cancer surgeon's point of view, are James and Lou's stories?
So firstly, James, I think that the awareness of breast cancer in men is not well known amongst men. Mm-hmm. It's growing amongst medical students and doctors, but you know, in my unit, I treat 150 women with breast cancer every year, and 1% of those are men. So at least in our Hertfordshire unit, we treat 4 or 5 men with breast cancer every year of a variety of ages. So your story is quite typical of a younger man,
yeah,
because you're under 50 and there's a genetic composition.
How old are you, James?
So I was diagnosed at 36. I'm 37 now.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think with men, first of all, that awareness is not there. That men often turn up to my clinic with their partners and wives saying, I'm making him come, he thinks it's fine. Mm. And they've got to be checked just as much as women do. And I think that the big issue with men is usually you're going to lose your nipple. Mm. Yes, that's a big issue for women, and we talk about that a lot and try our best as cancer surgeons to save the nipple if we can in women. But with men, usually because of the proximity of the lump behind the nipple, you lose it. Mm. And that has just as much impact on a man for his body image, because unless you have a lot of hair covering where that nipple was, you know, if you're single or if you're in a new relationship or if you're undressing in front of your kids to take them swimming, going to the beach, there's no nipple there. And that's why we still offer the nipple tattooing for men as well. But we treat everyone the same. We tailor the treatment according to you and what you've got. And that's where probably your surgeon changed the treatment according as information came through.
Of course, yeah.
And with Lou, that's very common. Actually, I think that the patients that have it hardest are probably the ones that start off with a little lump and you think, right, lumpectomy, I can do this.
Yeah.
And often we find on conventional breast imaging, so a mammogram and an ultrasound scan, in about 1 in 10 women in the UK, they will need to have a further operation, because what we can see and feel during the operation and when we check the margins on a mammogram machine during the operation may not tell us the active cells around the edge, and that's where you need further margins. And then often we say the third operation should be a mastectomy, because you can't keep putting a woman through it.
No way.
And therefore, planning, actually, even before you went through chemotherapy, look, you know, this is what we're going to do. And probably they talked about reconstruction with you.
Yes.
So fairly common.
Yeah.
The vast majority of women are picked up early. Breast cancers in women are picked up early. So the vast majority of women don't need a mastectomy. But as I say, everything is tailored according to what you have and what you need and what you want. And you mentioned earlier about a battle and presenting your choices. There should never be a battle with a breast surgeon.
I didn't
surgeon.
Use the word battle.
No, I think, I can't remember what you said, but
working with the surgeons.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And actually, I believe it's the other way around. Your surgeon is there to work with you.
Fair enough.
To get the treatment right. Yes,
can I ask what the most common misconceptions people have about breast cancer surgery?
Probably that you will have a battle. I hear that quite a lot. Women turn up really quite scared initially. And my job then is to alleviate the fears. Stop, listen. I want to hear about them. I want to know what's going on before they came through that door, because everybody's different. Mm. But the misconception is that your surgeon is going to tell you what you're going to have. And that is not true in the UK nowadays. And it's about advising our patients what they have, what the cancer is, what the choices for treatment are. And that can be scary, but then guiding them through the choice. So there will be no battle. We will be working with our patients, our women and men, to get the best treatment.
I think you have also said that surgery is a way, after a diagnosis, that a patient can take back some control.
Absolutely.
Now, control is a massive issue. From the people I've interviewed over the years, when you have a diagnosis, because you're out of control. Mm. You feel you have no control. So what do you mean by that? Because it's really important.
So I always, practically every woman and man that walks into my clinic, I say, this diagnosis has happened to you, usually through nothing you've done, but it's loss of control. Mm. You, for instance, gave the example of, you know, trying to deal with bereavement, looking after your children, a puppy, the house. You're in control of your family life and trying to put that jigsaw all together. And it's often that women are at the helm, but men too. And I'm not being sexist. No, it's just that it's whoever the patient is, control over their life has been taken away by an illness that doesn't actually make them feel ill. Mm. And therefore, by explaining what cancer is and actually explaining what the choices are, to give somebody options and give somebody a choice is really empowering because and it is actually clawing back that control. But telling them what's ahead, what the options are, and then guiding them through the choice, that's really, really important.
James, so in terms of the surgery, in terms of the possibility of losing your nipple, what happened and what was the outcome?
Well, I'm actually still kind of undergoing the surgical side of things. So I'm actually having, it was in the lymph nodes. It's like Fred and Ginger, you know, they kind of go together.
Not always.
Well, maybe not always. But so when I first was diagnosed. They took the biopsy from lymph node. It was inconclusive. Came back with a second biopsy, which came back as positive. Chemotherapy seemed to have worked. But as you'll know, you can only really tell the state of the cancer once you actually remove it and test it. So I had something called a targeted axillary, which is a removal of, I think it was 4 or 5 lymph nodes under my arm. And those came back as all cancerous. So next week I'm having a full axillary clear out. There are obviously ramifications for that in terms of things like lymphedema.
Absolutely.
So I kind of had that whole choice of sitting there and thinking, well, look, do I want to risk that or you know, do I want to go for radiotherapy?
Do you want to pause there? Do you want to explain what lymphedema is?
Yeah, so the function of the lymph nodes under the arm in all people is to filter the fluid coming back from the chest or the breast and the arm. So if we remove lymph nodes from under the arm, it can slow the passage of fluid back from the arm to back to the heart and the centre. And the risk, with the greater number of lymph nodes removed, the risk of lymphedema becomes greater. Mm. It doesn't happen to everybody, but that risk is there for life. Mm. So avoiding cuts and grazes on the arm, so on. So it's about the number, and it's really just fluid flow back to the heart.
But why is that a problem? What's wrong with it being slower? What are the risks?
So lymphedema can be really debilitating. If fluid is slowed in the arm, patients can get swelling, real heaviness for the arm, loss of function, which can be crippling,
Okay. Particularly
if it's in the dominant arm. So we have amazing lymphedema specialist nurses, particularly in the community, who can massage and compress. Mm. But it's once you have it, it's about managing it and reducing that debilitating issue.
Yeah. I believe it's about 1 in 3 chance, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's more surgery to come because of what's happening with the lymph nodes. Mm. This sounds such a personal question, but that's what we do on this
go
podcast.
For it, yeah.
What's the situation with your breast and nipple, James, if you don't mind me asking?
It's an X nipple currently.
Okay.
So I only have the one. What I will say is, so I had the self-image issues, thinking of a mastectomy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for me, they could get that clear margin. Right. My breast tissue was actually fine. It was in the duct. So actually, I haven't lost shape. You wouldn't know. Under a t-shirt, I think I'm sitting here now, and you wouldn't know.
No.
You know, you have to applaud the surgeon who did the work. I said, "This is fantastic." And she's like, "I thought you'd be pleased." I was like, well, I'm not pleased, but yeah, it's kind of the best we can do. So, you know, I'm doing regular exercises to make sure the sort of skin stretches. I haven't had any issues with things like cording, which I think you'll probably want to explain. So it's been quite, it's not been too bad actually, and I'm about 4 weeks out. And, you know, I'm actually kind of dealing with it okay.
So are you going to have a nipple tattoo or not?
I'm looking at options at the moment.
Yeah. Okay.
I think, you know, initially, you know, you always go worst case scenario in your head all the time. And I sort of
on that point, sorry to interrupt, James.
Right.
Did you want a double mastectomy?
No, I didn't want a double mastectomy.
Right, okay.
For me, it was about taking as little as possible, but without, you know, putting me at risk. But the genetic side came through, and that sort of guided what we thought was going to be the case. And it was only when I spoke to a geneticist that said, actually, in men, even with a gene, it's less likely, and you probably won't need that. But, you know, it kind of goes to show it's a learning process for everyone.
Yeah.
And the surgeon I have is a fantastic surgeon. But, you know, she sees so many cases of females. So, you know, if 2 + 2 = 4, that's how it works. But it's not always the case. It's bespoke, and sometimes 2 + 2 = 5 or 13 or 24.
Lou, I'll bring you in just a moment. But Harleen, what are the facts, the figures about the most common outcomes when it comes to surgery?
So we all know the earlier we catch breast cancer or it's detected, the better the outcomes. Mm. And we know that in men, who tend to present a bit later in older age, the outcome is slightly less, but actually about 95% of men and women live beyond 10 years. So the survival rates are some of the best for any cancer in the body, which is fantastic because the treatment just gets better and better.
Mm. And it will do as well as technology kind of comes in with AI and nanobots.
But chemotherapy treatments, drug treatments, tailoring the treatment to each individual patient and what they have is what makes them live longer.
Mm. Lou, did you have any idea how you would look after surgery?
No. None whatsoever.
How mad is that?
Beyond crazy. So when I was making a decision in terms of what type of reconstruction I was going to have for my mastectomy, I attended several clinics, met with several different specialists. And then I asked all the time if I could see what I would look like depending on which type of operation I was going to have. And so I'd already made the decision that for me, I didn't want to go flat. So then it was either a choice of did I want an implant or did I want to go down a Dieppe flap route, which is essentially using a part of my body. So we ended up using my tummy.
Skin from the tummy.
Build me a boob.
Yeah.
And so I can remember having a conversation whilst having my last chemotherapy session, lying in bed, talking to the breast specialist nurse, asking, can you help me in my decision-making? Can you show me some images? And then I remember her, you know, looking through her phone and scrolling through and looking at images online and then going, no. Mm. And she just said, do you know what? We don't have any images that we think are going to help you to make your decision. And whatever you do, don't Google it.
Right.
So
let me ask you as a surgeon, you're kind of shaking your head in kind of frustration as you're listening to Lou. It is a big deal.
Yeah. It's so scary. It's so scary because fear of the unknown is the worst thing. We all know that. So if you're being told, A, you're going to have your breasts removed, but you've got no visualization of how your own body is going to look, that just makes the scare, it makes the fear far greater. Mm-hmm. And I think, therefore, having photos from your surgeon of work they've done, of what the plastic surgeon can do, it's needed. It's vital. You know, every woman and man should be shown.
Yeah. Well, Lou,
also,
you've done...
Sorry, there's one other thing that's really important is breast reconstruction support groups.
Yeah.
And these are... They're growing in popularity, but actually we're very lucky to have one in Hertfordshire and in numerous areas in the UK. But it's where men and women who have had surgery and reconstructions or not reconstructions meet up with people that are about to have surgery, and it's literally no doctors and nurses, really informal, get your top off, have a look at my scar, talk about your journey, and that's really what everyone needs before they go into surgery,
which is why you've done something about this, Lou.
So my background is in project management, delivering global projects, unique mainly in tech and AI. So that's my background. And so when I was looking to grow myself back to work, I call it, after breast cancer and my husband dying, I thought about my frame was, if I only have 1 hour a day to work on a project that will help as many women as possible across the world, what can I do? And so I went to my friend, who is an award-winning photographer, and turned around and said to her, you know, this is the situation. Is there anything that we can do about it? And so we just started off photographing myself, looking at what that actually looked like on film. And then from that idea has grown into this incredible project where we have now just finished photo shoot 7. We'll be doing several more photo shoots. The project brief now includes doing a project with Birmingham University, where they're going to research the impact of the book in terms of women's mental health and how it's helped them. We've also got a group called the Evolved Group, which is an Australian-based company who are going to be doing a research project with us as well.
Right.
So we've grown this.
Someone's got surgery coming up.
Yes.
Let me look at some images.
Yes.
I would like that.
Yes. But more,
I want that one,
but more,
as they said in Little Britain.
But what we've actually done, which is the unique part, two aspects, is that the imagery is fine art portraiture style. So it's not medical.
Sure.
It's not graphic.
Yeah.
It's stunning, literally stunning, beautiful imagery that people can use to have a conversation.
Sure.
So you're still looking at, you know, quite hard-hitting images, but they're done in a way which is, you know, more easy to talk about without, so there are no faces in the photographs either, to enable women have a conversation and look at and analyse a body. and what that looks like.
Do you think you might eventually include men in that as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Great. So
would that have helped you, James?
Well, I'm very in a similar situation. There wasn't really something that I could kind of look at. Mm. And, you know, I spoke to a plastics specialist and I was actually told, well, it's not really the same for men as women, is it, really? Which made me angry.
Did
it?
It made me really angry.
Why? Go on.
Because one of the things about my journey and why I start Moves is, you know, look, there's 55,000 new diagnosing women per year to 370 in men. I completely understand why there's that disproportionate viewpoint of it all. But it was just one of those things that throughout my whole journey, it was almost as, you know, I'd go into an appointment and be like, oh, this is the breast clinic. Like, you're in the wrong place. And I was constantly sort of fighting things like this. And, you know, being told, and like I said, I don't blame anyone for this. It's the knowledge base isn't there. But it's sort of, you know, well, in women we do this. And, well, this is what we do for women. And whereas I understood that at the beginning, and, you know, the first leaflet I got was, wear a loose-fitting bra. And,
you were given a leaflet that advise you to wear a loose-fitting bra.
Yes. And that was on the day of my diagnosis.
I'm so sorry.
Do you know what? I found the funny side in it. And I said to my mum, let's go to a shop and get a loose-fitting bra. This is what I'm supposed
to do. Get fitted for a loose-fitting bra.
But I think it was, throughout a lot of it, it felt very much, I think, you know, I was 5 months down the line and a lot of my treatment was still, well, this is what we do in women. It's like, look, we've passed that stage now.
Come on.
You know, and you know, it's what you said yourself, Victoria, about working with these medical professionals. I'm the sort of person, I don't Google symptoms, I don't do any of that. I put my trust in someone.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I felt, I really need to take control of this myself. And so it wasn't really a surprise when someone said that. But it was upsetting the same.
Absolutely.
And that's why I started where I started. Good, it's just to have that peer-to-peer and also raise awareness of it.
I've got loads more questions from the Future Dreams community, people who've got in touch, particularly on Instagram. So let's whiz through these, if that's all right with you, Harlene. How much of your job is also about helping people regain their confidence?
A huge part of it. Actually, the operating and the operation is probably the smallest percentage time-wise out of my job. My primary goal and my job is to understand each patient and listen. What do they want? And I think that is listening to what they want, how they feel about their boobs or their moobs, and what they hope to achieve, and then giving them a realistic outcome. So a huge amount of listening, less operating, actually.
Is it true that one of the most common things you hear is, can you take both breasts off?
Yes.
Even if there's cancer in only one?
Yeah.
Really?
I think we had a real spike after we called it in the medical community, the Angelina Jolie effect.
She had a preventative double mastectomy.
Yeah. And it's very, very common, but I think it's becoming less because of the awareness that actually removing a healthy, normal breast, unless you're a BRCA carrier or another gene carrier, has no benefit to your long-term survival and good health.
I definitely asked for both.
Yeah,
it's a reflex. Get them off, get it away.
I live.
Even though there was only cancer in one, and then eventually having, you know, talked to the surgeon and what have you.
And that takes time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It takes time to be told and listen, yeah.
Mm. Fran asks this. In February 2021, I had a mastectomy done at my local hospital. It was during the pandemic and no reconstruction surgery was offered to me. That was a thing during the pandemic, wasn't it? You had to come back because they needed the time and the space and the surgeons to be doing pandemic related stuff. Mm. Fran says, how long after having a mastectomy can you ask to be referred for breast reconstruction? And does it make a difference if you have a diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer?
So a few issues to cover there, which I'll aim to do quickly, which the pandemic was, of course, horrendous. And in most hospitals in the UK, no reconstruction was offered. And as breast surgeons, we were all calling each other around the country, calling other colleagues, saying, this is just heartbreaking. I have never done a simple mastectomy with no reconstruction on a young woman unless she's wanted it. Mm-hmm. And now we're telling them. I was very, very fortunate in Hertfordshire. We were one of three or four units in the country where I looked at, I can do an implant reconstruction in only an additional half an hour to a simple mastectomy. So we used local private hospitals and continued doing reconstructions. But that wasn't the same for everyone.
No.
So when, if somebody had somebody's treatment planning reconstruction has been changed due to the pandemic, they've got to deal with all of their other treatment. And at the moment, due to funding in most areas in the UK, breast cancer patients are given about 2 to 3 years, depending on where you live, to choose if you want to have a delayed reconstruction, which is the reconstruction not at the time of a mastectomy. Now, if that was done during the pandemic, I would say that within the next couple of years, have that conversation, because at some point the people that fund NHS hospitals are going to say, well, you've had enough time to think about it. And that's a struggle we have, is that clinical commissioning groups and the people that fund NHS hospitals are giving us a time limit. We fight every day and often every few months to extend that time limit, particularly if patients have had chemotherapy. You're getting on with your life, you need to feel like not being a patient for a while before you come back and then have another operation. So the answer to that is it depends on the area that you live in, but start having those conversations with your surgeon and breast care nurse soon.
And if it's spread?
So if it's spread, we know that more and more patients in the UK are living with breast cancer that has spread, mm-hmm. and they are surviving longer and longer. So what we tend to do is work very closely, the patient, the oncologist, the clinical nurse specialist and the surgeon. Hopefully, when it gets to the point that metastatic disease or spread of breast cancer is kind of stabilised, or there's no sign of it because of the new amazing drugs that we have, then usually the oncologist and the surgeon will say, can I do the operation now? Is it worth doing? Because with the new medication, this patient may have another 10 years of living with this. So let's get on and do it.
Okay.
So yes, it is.
What if someone doesn't like the outcome of their surgery?
Yeah, and that's really important to talk to your surgeon with and the clinical nurse specialist. What don't you like about it? Come back and see your surgeon and talk to them. And I think it's really important to advocate for yourself, but that can be, again, scary. We're not very scary, most breast surgeons, but actually I would recommend making a list of things that you want to talk about. And if you've got a really good friend or a family member or, you know, the clinical nurse specialist, talk to them beforehand, bring them with you to the appointment so that if you get a bit nervous, you've got your list to refer to, but then you've got your mate next to you going, and you told me that you want bigger boobs and you can't live with these and it's really scary.
But can you have another surgery?
Yes. You can.
Even if it's simply because you don't like the way it's turned out.
I think
so. It's you know, on one level, it's a superficial reason. It's not about life or death.
But this is not cosmetic surgery.
No, absolutely
and
it's
that's
not.
That's the point.
Yeah.
So the point is that cancer surgery, we spend all of our lives training and perfecting the art of surgery to make sure it's not deforming. To then have a patient who is psychologically affected by the outcome, I would want to know about that. To know, is it the symmetry? We can offer symmetry surgery. Is it because you just don't like the look and feel of it? Well, let's come and discuss what your options are and be realistic about those.
On that point about cosmetic surgery, and this obviously not being cosmetic surgery, Lou, have you ever heard people say, oh, it's just a free boob job?
Oh, no.
But it sounds like you have, Harleen.
No one said that to me. But maybe that's because my circumstances were, you know,
very traumatic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But have you heard that?
I have. It's often from very well-meaning friends when, you know, getting to the point of a reconstruction is a process. It's not decided in one consultation one meeting.
Yeah.
It's several meetings.
Yeah.
Because you've got each woman, a man, or, you know, whoever's having the reconstructive surgery has to deal with how it's going to look and feel, mm-hmm. as the issues we've discussed. But then you can have a well-meaning friend who's come to advocate and support you, go, you'll end up with a great pair of boobs. And sometimes that can be really positive. And the patient thinks, actually, the silver lining is I will get rid of my mummy tummy. Mm. I will have those. But I think we all have to be so careful about flippant comments that are made. And you mentioned a flippant comment that a surgeon may have said, and it just stays with you and stays with you for years. So we just have to be a bit more cautious.
And it's funny,
that.
You never forget the flippant
comments.
No.
Quite often forget the gorgeous, divine, helpful, passionate stuff.
Yes, exactly.
But you always remember I prefer your hair short.
Oh, Christ. God.
I don't care.
Yeah. Don't care what you prefer.
Yeah, exactly.
Frankly.
Right, quick,
sorry.
Quick some more, Holly.
Yep.
Will a surgeon always try to save as much of the breast as possible?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So without question. It's better to keep your breast.
Is it better to have an implant behind the muscle or in front? I'm not even sure I really understand that question.
Yeah, sure. So When I was training, so years ago in the UK, we really had to do the mastectomy. So remove all of the breast tissue, keep the skin, but lift up the pectoral muscles, you know, the pectoral muscles that you can see more often in men, and the muscle underneath that sit on the ribs, lift those up to create a pocket for the implant. Now, that's what I was trained to do. And about 10 years ago, I just thought that my patients were getting younger and younger. That was a really painful operation that meant expanding the skin up and the muscle and stretching it. A long time in hospital, women with young kids or whatever they wanted to do couldn't go home and lift. So I then switched and taught myself and mentored with other surgeons in the UK to put the implant in front of the muscle with mesh, because for now 10 years I've been doing them as a day case operation, because women needed to get home to their young children or get back on the bike and go to work or whatever. The recovery is quicker, the cosmetic result is about the same, but I think it's a bit more natural when it's in front of the muscle.
Right. Can I just ask you a question about mesh? Because I've reported a lot on vaginal mesh and the awful problems it's caused.
Absolutely.
Some women over the years. Is it a different kind of mesh? It's not a mesh that can, as I've reported on, you know, protrude into the bowel and all the rest of it.
And that's to do with anatomy and the type of mesh gynecologists use. In the UK, we're using, I tend to use mesh that we've used in England, like groin hernias for years. We know it's safe. There are lots of different meshes, and every surgeon will prefer a mesh that works well with the implants they use. But it's every woman that's having an implant reconstruction will have a discussion about what type of mesh, why, showing photos so you can see that actually without a mesh, it may move around a bit too much, but it depends on the person. But they are very different meshes.
Fine.
There are issues that we're looking at long term. Are they safe? And constantly monitoring the safety of those.
Lou, what do you wish you'd known before surgery?
How great I was going to look after surgery.
Yes.
But who's going to be able to tell you that?
Well,
because, you know, surgeons don't know either.
Well, I was told that I would look really great afterwards, and to trust that I would look really great afterwards, and to trust that I had the best surgeons, which I did do. I did trust them.
Right. So you were told, you just didn't believe them.
I just didn't know what. I just didn't know
what that meant.
Because you hadn't seen.
Yeah,
or
how that would
photos.
Look like.
Yeah.
I can remember, so straight after the operation, so essentially they check your, what I called a boob beat, which is per Doppler in the middle of your boob, and they listen to see if the
blood supply
is working in your boob. And so I can remember the nurse coming along and placing this in my boob, and I'm thinking, oh my God, it's like she's putting something on my boob and it must be raw. She's literally inserting something right inside my boob. And I just couldn't figure out that actually that was the skin from my tummy that she was putting the Doppler on and listening to the heartbeat, literally, of my boob.
Wow.
And I just remember lying there going, this is incredible.
Yeah.
I look amazing. I can see my tummy, which had been, you know, disfigured after, you know, having babies, etc. And so that was all tight and nice, and my belly button was in a different place. And then I had this amazing boob.
Great.
What? Yeah.
James, what do you wish you'd known before surgery? And I appreciate this. There's more to come.
It's a tough question, that. I think... By the time I sort of kind of got to that journey, I was having the surgery side. I was kind of well aware of kind of what I was facing, but I think it's more pre that, and it was the whole, what am I going to have? So I think it would have been certainty. I mean, the ultimate decision was based on my very first mammogram, which was back in February, which showed that, you know, the breast tissue was actually clear. Mm-hmm. So realistically, I didn't have to go through that whole journey. So I think the only thing that I would have liked, and, you know, everyone's journey is uncertain, and it's one thing we have to all deal with. We've all been there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think as much certainty as possible is great. But like I said, I'm quite, even though I haven't had reconstructive surgery yet, that will come next year. I'm very happy with what my surgeon's been able to do. Yeah. You know, it's magic.
Not magic. It's absolute training over years.
Yeah, look at the scars under these eyes.
It's one of those things that I woke up from surgery. It was a day surgery.
Yeah.
I came out and I had dressings over the top, which is on for about 2 weeks. And so you're sort of sat there and you think, well, you know, I've got dressings on, but actually it doesn't look bad with the t-shirt. When it came off, it was like, oh, I was like, that doesn't actually look that bad. You know, so it maybe it is one of those things that being shown examples being told, look, this is what you're going to look like. And then it's not so scary.
Do you mind if I ask, may I ask James a question? When you found a lump, did you go into that clinic fearful that you had cancer?
Nope.
And that's the, I find that a huge difference between men and women coming to the clinic. Yep. Every single woman, whether we find out she's got a cyst or it's breast pain or something else, every woman comes in and she's already buried herself, she's writing her wills, and she has gone down that rabbit hole. And men kind of wander in. I think it's more of a shock because the awareness is not there about men and male breast cancer.
No, I agree. And I think actually the big thing for me, and you know, my GP was very, very good. Yeah. And the thing that was really, really lovely, so I don't like to bother doctors and things like that. I'm very stoic. So as I said, it took me 5 weeks before I went. And the GP actually booked to the point afterwards just for a catch-up. You know, and the first thing he said is like, it's not breast cancer. He's like, but I'm going to put you through anyway. And having that meeting afterwards, he was like, thank Christ I sent you. And he goes, you know, I'm never, ever in future going to doubt it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, when I met my breast consultant, the first thing she said before, even she goes, it's not breast cancer. It's not breast cancer.
I suppose that's, I mean... It's coming from a good place.
And
it's looking at the stats, isn't
it? Exactly.
So that's why it's not like they're not dismissing you.
Oh, no, of course not. No. It's just looking at the... Exactly. If you think about how much people need to learn in medical school, there has to be some level of stereotyping a little bit, thinking, look, you're young, you're man, it's not going to be this. Yeah. So I don't actually blame them for that at all.
Yeah.
But I think it kind of shows at that point, I was going in and thinking, well, of course it's not. It's like, well, I've got a meeting in an hour. You know,
Let me ask you, Harleen, finally,
of course,
for people listening to this podcast, obviously, hopefully, they'll have heard some really good advice here and some good conversation about, you know, the imagery and all that sort of stuff. What would you say to someone listening now who is preparing for breast cancer surgery?
Speak up. Tell your team, the nurse and the surgeon, what you want. They can then tell you what they can hope to achieve. Ask to see photos. Ask if there is a breast reconstruction group that they could join. If it's not in the local area, is there something online? Can they be put in touch with people? Information and support is key. And you can't have too, you can have too much information, but trust your team, but ask questions and don't be afraid of anybody, because we spend our lives trying to help every single person and individualise their care. We can only help if we know what you're thinking and what you want. Speak up. We will listen.
And I would just like to say, actually, so all of my breast care team are advisors on the book that we're producing.
Yeah,
and it wasn't that they didn't want to show me imagery. They just didn't have the right imagery to help me make a decision, which I think is quite different. And that's the key piece that we're trying to identify, is what is the right imagery to help.
I need your book.
No, I think it's one of those things that kind of everyone needs to be more aware of. I think when I was in, I was being told I had surgery because I have self-image issues. I actually asked about reconstruction. Good. There was uncertainty whether it was on the NHS.
Yeah.
And so you're sitting there.
I mean, that is just ridiculous. I know, absurd.
It was about,
of course it's on the bloody NHS.
It was about 3 months. It was about 3 months before I was actually told, well, of course it is.
Wow.
But it was that uncertainty. Yeah. So, you know, I was there looking at private surgeons to kind of think and shot me afterwards.
I'm sorry.
But, yeah.
Thank you, all of you. Thank you so much
for your
very helpful advice and for you being so open about your own experiences.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Victoria.
And
it's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's really good to hear from you. Thank you. And Then Came Breast Cancer is brought to you by the Future Dreams Breast Cancer Charity, which provides practical, emotional and psychological support for anyone diagnosed with the disease. And also, please like and subscribe to this podcast wherever you are listening to it. I know it sounds odd, but actually it will really help us get a sponsorship for future series. So please do that. We'd be really, really grateful. And Then Came Breast Cancer is a Factory original and 6 Foot 6 production.
Our podcast is intended to be a message of support for everyone who has been touched by breast cancer, and that's why our guests share their personal and unique stories with you. They express their personal opinions, which don't necessarily reflect those of Future Dreams or our sponsors. Our guests' individual stories do not constitute medical advice and shouldn't be treated in any way as a substitute for professional expertise or a consultation with healthcare professionals. This podcast is not offering to treat your cancer, but it is trying to help by talking about it. So hopefully you realise that you are not alone.